Good evening and welcome to the talking show on K Chung Radio, Chinatown's only.
Only.
That's right. Only.
Only.
Micro broadcasting radio solution. My name is Nicholas Miller.
That's right.
And I'm here, as always, with the inimitable, the defatigable, the otherworldly,
ooh,
Stephen Cato.
Hi, everyone. My name is Stephen Cato. Nice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Steve just huffed it all the way over here on his super fast bicycle.
Yeah.
You guys can't see out there in the studio, but Steve's legs are getting buff.
So
he's been cycling just about everywhere. Isn't that right, Steve?
My quads are so blasted. It is crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
And during Steve's mini cycling efforts, he listens to BBC Radio on his headphones. And so I'm sure, Steve, you catch us all up on the latest scandal by the United States President Donald Trump.
Well, you know, I think our listeners have other places to go for the news. They can just listen to the BBC if they want to. I think one thing I'd like to put in is that I don't actually listen to the news while cycling because it's dangerous. Please, if you are, like me, cycling on the roads of Los Angeles, you must keep your wits about you. Do not wear earphones. I know that it feels good and very cinematic to glide on a bicycle, especially in such beautiful weather where there is a perfect climate, perfect wind, everything. You want to listen to music while you do that, or maybe you think it would be useful to take in information while you are in transit. But please, please do not listen to headphones or earbuds of any kind while cycling. It is fantastically unsafe. Do not do it. Priuses, for example, are capable of sneaking up. They make almost no sound when they're running on their electric motors. You could be killed by a Prius in a second. So just, you know, don't. I'll stop there. Don't. About the latest scandal, I think the Michael Flynn situation, I think we've known about this for months. Everyone has known these guys are in Russia's pocket anyway. So, you know, these ties have been long reported. There was that campaign aide who got turfed midway through. You know, the Secretary of State is like deep bros with Vladimir Putin. I mean, like, nothing new here, folks. It's nice to see that it's being taken seriously, I guess. That's nice. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's not a big surprise that he was, who knows, in cahoots with the Russian government.
Yeah.
As if they hacked Hillary's server, just for fun.
I forgot about that even, you know, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just for kicks.
Right? My uncle, who's radically conservative and pretty far to the right, he keeps saying, especially after the Ninth Circuit debacle, that the Democratic Party should really just relax, just sip, get some popcorn, sit back, and watch this guy completely decimate his presidency.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
I mean, it's easy from his armchair to say that. Hopefully, this process of decimation does not harm any more lives than it already has. But he is making a proper fool of himself. And speaking of Russia and global politics, we have a very interesting...
Thank you, Moshe.
It's
a pleasure to be here.
Speech tonight.
Just got off the...
About artworks.
Train from Liverpool.
And global politics.
For 3 weeks, so
I won't keep you guys any longer.
Suffering from a bit of
In keeping with our 1970s UC San Diego tribe,
may have more to do with
we have
with London.
The one, the only,
take the lights down.
Alan Sekula.
Last year, Bill Gates, the chairman of Microsoft, purchased Winslow Homer's painting from the mid-1880s, Lost in the Grand Banks, for the highest price ever paid for an American painting, $30 million. It's one of three large-size paintings that Homer made in the 1880s depicting the lives and deaths of North Atlantic cod and halibut and herring fishermen, dory fishermen, in the New England fleet. And it struck me as strange and perplexing that Bill Gates would develop a taste for this painting, because in a sense, Gates's whole project entails the objective of never being lost, of always being connected, and of being connected globally. One might say voraciously so. And so there's an odd pathos to his desire to own a painting of a solitary fisherman trying to discern the schooner to which he would like to return in a fog bank which has descended. And this, in fact, was a depiction of a calamitous occurrence that was quite common on the Grand Banks. Many dory fishermen would drift for days before dying of thirst or starvation or exposure when they were cut off from the ships from which they were dispatched. You could almost say that Homer's project in these heroic scale paintings was not dissimilar in a documentary sense from the photographs made 20 years later by Lewis Hine. That is to say, his effort was to reveal something of the actual conditions of work. In this case, a subject that was impossible to photograph by the means available at the time, but which could be represented by drawing or painting. And I began to speculate about Gates's private desires in purchasing such a painting, and of course I can't read his mind, but I decided to think about the painting's point of view, this odd suspended height above the swells, which I think nonetheless allows us to infer a lower position, the position of someone like the dory fisherman, who at one moment can see, when lifted high on the swell, the horizon line, or could see the horizon line if fog hadn't obscured it, but at the next moment it's plunged down into the trough of the wave and faces only the immediacy of water close at hand. Something related to the swimmer's point of view, the ocean swimmer's point of view, which varies with the swell. And so I decided, and unfortunately I can't illustrate this for you, I decided to try to photograph Mr. Gates's house on Lake Washington in Seattle from the same point of view. And I did that in early September. I went out on a boat and went into the water for about a half hour at dusk using a underwater camera, a diver's camera, and I photographed his house, sometimes with the swell from passing boats, which, as it turns out, take a kind of touristic interest in witnessing the luxury of Gates's mansion on the lakefront. Can we bring the lights down again? Thanks. And And so I thought that perhaps by actually subjecting myself to a very mild and insignificant near case of hypothermia, I could learn something about why Gates would like this painting. I suppose what interests me in a way is how the sea is returned to the consciousness of late 20th century elites. I produced the work Fish Story between 1987 and 1995 on the premise that the sea had vanished from the conceptual horizon of late modernity. And now I think I have to revise somewhat that premise. If any two images are emblematic of the larger project of Fish Story, which entails 96 photographs in a book sequence and 105 photographs in exhibition form and related texts of various kinds, it would be these two photographs, which I think are set up as a kind of implied diptych to suggest a movement between the classical space of the sea, which is panoramic, and the modernist space of the sea, which emerges in the mid-19th century, roughly coincident with the development of steam power for sea travel. And that, I believe, is a space of the detail. And what, in effect, these two photographs show you are a kind of relationship between a contemporary container vessel in mid-passage across the Atlantic and the device that measures the list of the vessel, an inclinometer. And what interested me then is this tension between the panorama and the detail, but also the way in which the panorama here entails an imposition of a terrestrial, centrally perspectival ground plan similar to the tile floors found in Cinquecento Italian Renaissance paintings, the imposition of that ground plan upon the surface of the sea, a kind of terrestrialization of the sea. And that connected for me to the idea that the fluidity of the sea was, in effect, being erased by a new fixity of transport routes, and that the land, in fact, had become, at least the land as a site of production, had become much more fluid with late modernity and with capitalist notions and programs of global manufacturing. As far as the photo on the left goes, what interested me is the relationship between the spatial measure, the fact that we're looking at essentially 5 degrees of an arc or of a circle, and yet we can also transpose this or transcode it into a temporal measure, as if the bubble of the inclinometer were the ship traveling on the circumference of the Earth 3.5 days into its voyage. So in some ways, what I'm interested in is taking spaces that appear abstract or appear connected to abstract logics of commodity flows and financial distance, let's say, from the world of utility and kind of material processes, and then somehow approaching these subjects photographically in such a way that they take on a new materiality at another level. In Canadian Notes, earlier work from the mid-1980s, I tried to look both at Arthur Erickson's Bank of Canada building in Ottawa and the industrial space of nickel mining in Sudbury in northern Ontario. And I suppose what amused me about this juxtaposition which is perhaps as emblematic as the pairing that I've tried to show you from Fish Story, is that these foundry workers or smelter workers appear to be at leisure while the process proceeds seemingly automatically, though in fact what we're seeing is only an interval between their own labor. And what you see in the photograph of this worker's lounge at the Bank of Canada is the impressions of the sitting workers who've gotten up from their coffee break. And in fact, in a print of the photograph, you can see that there are cigarette burns in the naugahyde furniture from the hasty putting out of a smoke on the return to the computer data processing work. And then there's the nice fact that these red naugahyde chairs reflect in the window in such a way that the Houses of Parliament appear to have taken on the look of Red Square. So back to Fish Story for a moment. So one thing I tried to photograph in Fish Story, particularly in the chapter that deals with the what I call the middle passage, sort of borrowing the what is primarily an Caribbean and African American phrase for the slave crossing, and this is a passage on by container vessel from New York City via Norfolk, Virginia to Rotterdam. And what interested me was the solitude of the work and certain residues of the age of sail, the chief mate climbing the container stack to check the temperature of refrigerated containers, the one daily act on the vessel that in any way evokes the notion of scaling the mast to handle the sails. And then this sort of ghostly boiler suit in a passageway. So that, in many ways, given the automation of contemporary ships and the scaling down of crews, every vessel is a ghost ship. And to come back to the point about the relationship between elite conceptions of the sea's return and another point, which is more popular, or if you want to put it in old-fashioned terms, more proletarian views of the sea in the contemporary world. I want to develop sort of a few comments about the reception of Fish Story. The work was originally shown in Rotterdam, and then it traveled to Stockholm, to the Moderna Musée. It went to Scotland, to Glasgow, to Tramway, and then finally to two spaces in Calais. So all maritime cities of very different sorts. No one in the United States was terribly interested in the exhibition. And then finally, I had two exhibitions, one in 1996 at the Santa Monica Museum of Art, and then just this past winter, at the Henry Art Gallery in Seattle. And by this time, quite a number of people who worked in port trades had found out about the work. Oddly enough, I mean, a book published in Germany, you know, an exhibition that was European. But people heard about it and were very interested in it. And I was invited to exhibit in Seattle by a kind of odd alliance of the Art Museum at the University of Washington and the Department of Labor Studies, which has the unique status of actually having a chair funded by retired dock workers. It's called the Harry Bridges Chair, named for the famous West Coast American trade unionist. And I think I have to focus here a bit, I'm sorry. What's that? So in Seattle, I had a unique experience of being able to actually talk with an audience of port workers who came to the show with great interest. And I just wanted to sort of develop a kind of anecdotal, perhaps only anecdotal insight into the differences between kind of class readings of the sea. Early on in the exhibition, I kept going up from Los Angeles. I live in Los Angeles, and I would go up repeatedly. I had a kind of residency in Seattle. And at different times, different groups of people would come through the show. And at one point, I was present when a group of trustees, younger trustees of the Henry Art Gallery, went through the exhibition. Many of them were people in their 30s and 40s who made quite a lot of money in the computer industry and have retired, essentially. And they're no longer working in computer work because they've made a killing. And the thing that really grabbed them in the exhibition was this one vertical triptych that intersects the Middle Passage. Structurally in the exhibition, the Middle Passage sort of proceeds linearly, and then there's a vertical triptych that cuts through it. And what it represents is an intersection of the container vessel I was on and a drifting sailboat that happened to have been caught and apparently rolled in a storm. And following the conventions of the sea, the vessel I was on brought, with great effort, brought the drifting sailboat into the onto its lee side. The chief mate, who we saw earlier climbing the container stacks, who seemed to get all the sort of exceptional dirty work on the ship, which is sort of how you become a ship's master, I suppose, descended and discovered the body of a dead American. The name of the boat was the Happy Ending, and its home port was Anaheim, which is all the more ironic because Anaheim is not on the coast. So the whole thing had an odd, macabre, Disney-esque aspect to it. And this was the element of the work that really interested these trustees. That is, the lone sailor at sea, a kind of unusual calamity. Oops, I'm sorry. Excuse me for that. That slide's reversed, but it's kind of vertiginous anyway. It's even better that way. I like it that way. It's good with that. The best way to see it is three in a stack. But in any event, now the image that haunted, so this is the image that haunted, let's say, an upper class viewer in this particular instance. But the image that haunted the port workers, the dockers who came to the exhibition was this image of a robot terminal in Rotterdam, where the ship finally made port, where the truck drivers who pick up the containers underneath the hammerhead cranes have been replaced by these automated vehicles. So that image was haunting for workers. And then images like this, the bosun driving the forward winch as the ship moors in Rotterdam, an image that I hoped would suggest something of the backwards and forwards cycle of, oscillation of transatlantic labor. And then this pair of ear protectors in the engine room with this caustic slogan produced with a Dymo labeler, "I cannot be fired, slaves are sold." So there's very different readings of the seas. There's a sense of, for people who work in port labor or in seafaring, of a kind of violence that exists on an everyday level, that's grinding and routine, occasionally calamitous, always dangerous. And then there's an elite sense of the sea as a place where disasters are intermittent, sudden, surprising, and would call to mind heroic efforts and great tragedies. And of course, this elite sense corresponds much more to the prevailing media representation of the sea. Now, if Bill Gates's purchase of Winslow Homer's Lost in the Grand Banks is one instance of the sea's return, I'd like to turn to another, which is Frank Gehry's Guggenheim Bilbao. And what I have to say about this building is quite provisional, and I'm, of course, feel that I'm no more than an amateur in speaking of architecture, but I have followed Gehry's work for some time. Gehry figures along with Richard Neutra in Fish Story, although only in a fairly minor way. But of course, the entire discourse of Frank Gehry's Guggenheim Bilbao is caught up with notions of the restoration of vitality to a derelict maritime city. I mean, this is one of the first utterances one encounters in the voluminous literature on Gehry's project. And of course, the building is both a ship and a fish. Of course, it occupies the site of a former shipyard of Astilleros Españoles. Of course, it's thought that the building will, in effect, bring about a kind of revitalization of the riverfront of Bilbao. But there are a couple of other levels of meaning that interest me. I set out to photograph the building last December, and what I tried to do is give a wider angle on the building than is typically the case in architectural photography. It's very common for photographers who represent Gehry's Guggenheim to climb the hill on the other side of the river, sometimes even higher than I climbed. But what I tried to do is show the degree to which the relative affluence of the riverfront development is a kind of Potemkin village, behind which you have something that corresponds to the difficulties of economic life in the Basque Country. So that space behind the railroad tracks interested me very much. The other thing that interested me about Gehry's building is the idea, which I think is quite pronounced. It's perhaps most clearly articulated in the writings of Kurt Forster. The idea that the building is a kind of token or totem is perhaps a more accurate word of the modernity of the aerospace industry. So the titanium is a metal associated with aircraft manufacture. And it's as if a new metal has been introduced to a space of old metal, of iron and steel, of shipbuilding, of heavy weights. And so the ship and fish is also a kind of aeronautical phantasm. And if one examines the semiotics of titanium, one finds something rather peculiar. For example, titanium is not used for aircraft skin manufacture. It's used in alloyed form with steel for turbine blades, because it allows turbine blades to function at high temperatures without the degradation that would occur if they were made of steel only. I know this because I was a chemical technician and I actually worked with the etching of titanium using hydrofluoric acid, and It struck me as even more ironic that there is a container transfer terminal to the side of the museum. And when I visited, there were actually many containers full of hydrofluoric acid. So I had to imagine an industrial accident in which the fumes would, in effect, dissolve Gehry's building. Further, the titanium is a metal which has come to be associated with high-end luxury consumer products, German-designed cameras. It's taken on a kind of luxury connotation that I think is worth considering when we see Gehry using the metal. But beyond this, there's also a way in which the building is a kind of light modulator. That is, it's introduced a new level of specularity and optical irritation into the boring tertiary palette of this backward industrial city. So that it's as if the kind of optical interference that one associates with Los Angeles, with its glare, with its smog light, has been helpfully, in a kind of paternalistic North American gesture, transplanted to the Basque Country. Now, I know that it's been the case that the building has been adopted very enthusiastically by people in Bilbao, and has taken on yet other connotations, but it seems to me that there's an interesting kind of ambivalent maritime set of associations with this building. It cannot be wholly, its organicism, its vitalism, something that Kurt Forster has spoken about. Its fishiness also has to have a kind of transcendental and anti-organic component. And that aspect, I think, is associated with the titanium cladding the building. I found it difficult to photograph and decided that I would wait. I would take a lesson from Claude Lorrain and wait until the sun had dropped so that the whole tonality of the image would shift downward. And actually, this is kind of work in progress. I'm really trying to think about the relationship of Gary's structure to much more primitive structures, you know, metal structures like this sheet metal clad fisherman, or sheet metal period fisherman's hut in the Loire Valley in France along the Ande River. Oh, that's interesting. A little bit of Liverpool moisture boiling off the slide there. All right. Sorry. I've just gotten flustered. You'll have to excuse me. All right. Give me 1 second to read. All right, third example of the sea's return, the making and distribution of the film Titanic by James Cameron. What the photograph on your left depicts is the set for Titanic in Popotla on the Baja California coast about 50 miles south of the U.S.-Mexican border. What 20th Century Fox did was to build the world's largest freshwater filming tank in Popotla, hoping to take advantage of cheap Mexican labor, both in building the set and in the technical jobs of film production. The plan is to make as many as 20 films on this site, the first of which was Titanic. Popotla is a small fishing village. Ironically, it has no running water, even though they have this gigantic tank of fresh water. And in fact, the efflux of fresh water into the tide pools below the cliff on which the set was built caused wrecked havoc with the ecosystem of mussels and other shellfish that were the mainstay of the fishermen's livelihood. And what you see here on the right, these are all of these diptychs that you see are essentially consecutive frames. And so I've moved a few paces to my right, and I'm looking down the slope from the set at two of these fisher folk cooking mussels on an open fire, and these are the characteristic shanties in which they live. On the right is another aspect of the coastal zone along the U.S.-Mexican border on the Pacific coast, a gigantic Hyundai container factory. 80% of the world's containers are manufactured in China, but there is a large factory in Mexico. Largely building containers for the North American market, and what I photographed here is the factory, and then moving slightly, a wall of an abandoned building, partially ruined building, with a trucker's graffiti, and the trucker's graffiti is in this interesting trompe l'oeil. I think it's going to be hard for you to see here, but the truck sort of bends around the corner of the wall, so that if you look from a 45-degree angle, it would be in proper perspective, though it has some odd quasi-cubist aspects as well. And it's a fairly accurate representation of a refrigerator truck with this odd name on the roof, Chespiro, which is a very droll Mexican joke. There's an actor, a comedian on Mexican television named Chespirito, which means little Shakespeare. So Shakespeare is big Shakespeare, and it's apparently the sort of the brag of an outlaw trucker who's shipping marijuana from Mazatlan north to the American border. So the graffiti relates to a whole culture of corridos and sort of gangster songs that are very popular in northern Mexican border culture. So I was trying to look at these, you know, the Titanic operation of 20th Century Fox in relation to this other industrial presence. And this work is called Dead Letter Office, and it's one of several sequels to Fish Story, where I'm looking at maritime space but trying to examine other other spaces. I was very keen to do something on this border zone. It was commissioned for a large, multinational North and South and Latin and Central American exhibition, which took place between Tijuana and San Diego. I refused to show my work in the U.S. and insisted that it be shown in Tijuana, which was great, great fun. Is this just a reminder? Or, in any event. All right, let me go forward here. And one thing I did in Mexico was to look at, and now I'm going to talk about the dimension of globalism's discontents, and particularly the kind of certain kind of militants that I think is beginning to emerge. These are workers for Hyundai subcontractors. On the left, a worker in an Ensenada shipyard. Ensenada is the Mexican port city about 80 miles south of the border. And on the right, a worker for a steel cutting firm working for Hyundai, subcontracting to Hyundai. And the group of workers in the picture on the right are signing authorization cards for an independent union. So they're attempting to break away from the Mexican ruling party's state-controlled unions. And this has been a key site of class conflict on the northern Mexican border, the formation of these independent unions. The workers on the right are at risk of arrest. They can be arrested without any kind of habeas corpus rights. They can wait in jail for weeks before being charged. Nonetheless, as you can see, they've brought children with them. You can see the shoes of a small child. None of them had pens. They had to borrow pens in order to sign these authorizations. So it's a quite moving risky situation in many respects, and I felt privileged to be able to document it. As it turns out, this particular group of workers failed in their fight, but there's another group at another company, also working for Hyundai, that have continued to push their cause forward. So this is a dimension of what I've been looking at. Two more pictures from this project Dead Letter Office, which perhaps bring us closer to my Melvillian source for the title, which is the short story Bartleby the Scrivener. If you know the story, you know that at the very end, Bartleby's boss imagines that his truculence and catastrophic decline is the outcome of his having worked for a period of time at the American Post Office's Dead Letter Office, and that the sheer psychic violence of witnessing, you know, and handling letters that never reached their sender drove him to the state, his final state. So here's the Titanic sort of sinking into its earthen grave. I suppose for me a way of suggesting that the film has in a way nothing to do with the sea, that it, as much as the sea returns, it's a kind of tamed sea. You know, there's no weather, there's no, there is a sense of the deluge below decks, but beyond that, it's a fair rather terrestrial film. So I like this idea of a grave for the ship, or a grave, and I like the idea that the lighting stands were like the skeletons in Jason of the Argonauts. You know, these sort of skeletal figures. And then on the right, a coffin factory in Tijuana, small shop making coffins, some for the American market, some for the Mexican market. And the workers have figured out a kind of erotic solution to their daily confrontation with Thanatos, and so they've covered the wall with pinups, sort of rather chaste and robust Mexican-style pinups. And you notice that there's a pile of shredded paper on the right. Well, it turns out that the shredded paper is used to pad, you know, the body in the coffin, usually encapsulated in a polyfilm layer. So one has to imagine that these pinups might well be shredded and provide a kind of bed for the deceased. So in a way, I was taking my metaphor of the cargo container as the coffin of remote labor power quite seriously here. But I was also thinking of a very interesting Mexican film from 1933, a film by Arkady Beutler called La Mujer del Puerto, The Woman of the Port, which is a kind of translation of a Guy de Maupassant short story set in Marseille to Veracruz with all sorts of Mexican carnivalesque additions. So it's a bit of an homage to that film by Arkady Beutler, which stars Andrea Palma, who's sometimes described as the Marlena Dietrich of Mexico. Oops, I'm doing it again. Excuse me. All right. I'm now getting to the work that's in Liverpool, and I should say that that what I did in Liverpool was to take a work I made last summer called Freeway to China, and expand it for Liverpool. So what I did was to imagine a connection between Liverpool and Los Angeles. It's fairly common when one thinks about maritime history to connect Liverpool and New York, and there are also very profound architectural linkages between Liverpool and New York. You know, there was a park on the other side of the river that inspired Central Park, for example. Of course, there was, you know, the two ports were connected through trade and passenger travel. The original work, the summer before last, I showed at the new Getty Center, in the small galleries at the Getty Research Institute, and I was trying in a way to suggest that the implicitly, what I was trying to suggest is that all the attention to the $2 billion Richard Meyer Getty Center, on a strictly financial level, sort of paled in comparison to the $5 billion being spent to build new infrastructural improvements leading to the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, something called the Alameda Corridor. And that this was in on a kind of base material level, the industrial counterpart to the grandiosity of Richard Meyer's cultural theme park or palace on the hill. So I went down to the port, and I'd been photographing there for quite some years. But what I looked at is the expansion of the port, and I'm just going to read you some of the text from the work. Which these prints are fairly large, and the text is sort of placed on the wall with transfer letters. This is from the main text. Today, the relationship between the sea and the land is increasingly the opposite of what it was in the 19th century. Sites of production become mobile while paths of distribution become fixed and routinized. Factories are now like ships. They mutate strangely, masquerade, and sometimes sail away stealthily in the night in search of cheaper labor, leaving their former employees bewildered and jobless. And cargo ships now resemble buildings, giant floating warehouses, shuttling back and forth between fixed points on an unrelenting schedule. The contemporary maritime world offers little in the way of reassuring and nostalgic anthropomorphism, but surrenders instead to the serial discipline of the box. The cargo container, an American innovation of the mid-1950s, transforms the space and time of port cities and makes the globalization of manufacturing possible. The container is the very coffin of remote labor power, bearing the hidden evidence of exploitation in the far reaches of the world. The combined ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach are the biggest in the Americas, and now rank third or fourth in the world in container volume. Massive public investments in new rail lines, bridges, and container and coal export terminals costing more than $3 billion will more than triple the cargo capacity of the Port of Los Angeles. There's another $2 billion, but it's more complicated in its relation to all of this. These infrastructure projects are largely hidden from public scrutiny, and the port remains unrecognized and invisible. In this sense, the Port of Los Angeles is the very exemplar of the postmodern port, vast functionalized tracks for container operations built upon ever-expanding landfill far from the metropolitan center. No one would describe Los Angeles as a maritime city, a port with a present and an optimistic future, but oddly indifferent to its own past. Plans for Los Angeles port expansion were based on optimistic projections of continued manufacturing growth in East and South Asia. The recent Asian economic crisis has called these projections into question. Falling currencies may raise hopes of export-driven recovery on the backs of impoverished workers, but the complex global logistics of the system creates new blockages and economic sinkholes. The balance of trade slips radically, with many containers returning to Asia from Los Angeles holding nothing but air. Crisis or boom, with its low wages, South China is now a primary industrial hinterland for the Port of Los Angeles. The delirious or cynical official claim that the sunken rail lines of the new Alameda Corridor will promise to create 700,000 jobs both rings hollow and begs the question, where? As one Los Angeles dock worker put it, gazing out at the rising bulwark of Pier 400 dredged up from the bottom muck of the outer harbor, pretty soon they'll just drive the containers over from China. So the work is called Freeway to China. And based on that wonderfully ironic comment that I overheard, let me just read you the caption to the photograph on the left. The Teal, it's the name of a ship, berthed at Pier 300 after unloading two of four German cranes transported across the Indian and Pacific Oceans from a construction site in Abu Dhabi on the Persian Gulf, where they were manufactured by Filipino and other South Asian migrant laborers. Belgian-owned, the Teal is registered in the Netherlands Antilles, a pervasive legal ruse that permits the hiring of cheaper foreign crews. Orange and blue are the utopian colors of Southern California, the color of the region's first great agricultural export product, and the color of the water stolen and transported 200 miles by aqueduct to make that product grow. Irrevocably connected to larcenous beginnings, these complementary colors were adopted by the Los Angeles-based oil giant Unocal, which nowadays builds for a lucrative future in Burma. Orange is also the color of rust, and curiously enough, of rust-resistant paint as well. Orange is also the color of the fires of hell, unless you read Milton, who imagined otherwise. Blue is the color of the sea. In Liverpool, orange and blue taken together mean different things, especially on July 12th, when the Orange Order takes to the streets. At the Tate Gallery on Albert Dock, any day of the year, rain or shine, orange and blue are architect James Stirling's way of saying that things are looking up after the fires of the Toxteth riots of 1981, taking us back, as it were, to the pop optimism of the swinging 60s. So what I wanted to do was write a caption that would explode, basically. You know, it sort of sounds like a regular photographic caption, and then it goes somewhere else. And this is the German engineer supervising the unloading of the cranes. And unfortunately, I didn't get his name. And then Mason Davis, former shipyard machinist and the shop steward on the job, who's working here as a welder in precarious employment. And he told me that this was the first real work he'd had over in a year. And as my caption says later, I tried to find him, track him down, to give him a print of this photograph. He'd moved off to New York in search of work, and I couldn't find him. On the left, Yuri Smolin, a Russian sailor from Moscow, loading more orange paint on the ship. It's not orange enough for them. It's always got to be repainted. And then Mason Davis and a colleague loading gas canisters onto the ship to begin the process of cutting loose the bracing for the cranes. And then on the left, Louisa Gratz, she's a president of a longshore dockers local in, actually a warehouse workers local, but part of the longshore union in Los Angeles. And she's just negotiated with ship owners at a terminal after a wildcat strike action in support of Australian dock workers. And I'll say more about that later. And then on the right, a picture called A Thousand Trucks. And this is a strike of mostly Latino immigrant truck drivers who haul containers to and from the port of Los Angeles. And they're trying to be recognized as wage workers, even though they're classified as independent owner operators. And their slogan for a time was very funny, though it has to be translated from American. It was, or from I should say from Spanish and American. It was W-2C, then 99, no. And the W-2 is the tax form you fill out if you're a wage worker, and the 1099 is the form you fill out if you're self-employed. So they were removing their trucks from the waterfront. This is out by the Fontana Steel Mill, which you may know about from Mike Davis's book, City of Quartz. They're parked between the demolished steel mill, which was sold to the People's Republic of China in parts and reassembled, and the new San Bernardino County Jail, which is the new growth industry in that part of California. It's about 80 miles from the port. It's a very interesting job action. They're actually, in the print, you can tell that little building with the neon is a bail bonds office. Yeah. All right, so Port of Los Angeles is really a port with no sense of its maritime identity, as I said earlier. That had a lot to do with the fact that the port was quite distant from the city center. So in this early 1870s photograph, you can see that you just have a few rocks piled up, and somebody's helpfully written San Pedro, California. And then you have some ships at anchor about a mile offshore. And then from the 20s, from a Chamber of Commerce booster pamphlet, an attempt through juxtaposition to suggest proximity between the port and the city center. But it's very much the opposite condition from the condition of Liverpool, where the city center is a kind of grand statement of kind of mercantile presence on the waterfront. Now, the route to Liverpool from Los Angeles for me went by way of Australia. So it gets even more complicated, because in last year, the Australian government tried to break the Australian Dock Workers Union, and they trained paramilitary operatives, many of them veterans of the Australian SAS, in Dubai to operate cargo handling equipment, and came in and basically had a kind of police and military takeover of the ports. Dock workers around the world responded to this, and particularly dock workers on the west coast of the U.S. who have a sentimental tie to Australia because Harry Bridges, their leader in the 1934 strike, which allowed them to organize and end the brutally exploitative casual labor system that had preceded that fight, Bridges was Australian. He was an Australian seafarer who emigrated in the 20s to California. And so here's a picket in Los Angeles turning around an Australian ship, the Columbus Canada, sending it back to Australia with its containers full of things like mutton, and costing ship owners about $10 million. So I made this, the scale is off here because of the slides, but the picture on the left is much smaller and the picture on the right is much bigger. And what I wanted was this kind of double diptych, a vertical diptych with a partial frame, 1 1/3 frames, with the focus pulled, suggesting an action that was having an effect in the antipodes. And then the image of the picket, a kind of more traditional sort of political journalistic type photograph. Now, this then linked to the fight of the Liverpool dockers who had been sacked, 500 of them sacked in 1995, and who fought for 28 months and finally had to give up. And when I was invited to show in the Liverpool Biennial, I was delighted because Liverpool was one of the cities that had wanted to make central to Fish Story and wasn't able to for reasons of plane tickets and train schedules. I was able to go to Glasgow and Newcastle, but not to Liverpool. And then I'd followed the struggle of the Liverpool dockers and in fact had screened Ken Loach's film on their fight, made in the middle of the fight, of four dock workers in the West Coast in the US on three different occasions, in Seattle, in Berkeley, and in Los Angeles. And I was very touched by the fact that that the dock workers had actually flown up to Berkeley from Los Angeles to see the film before it was even possible to arrange a later screening in LA. And so I was very moved by that, and that sort of led to the conditions of my showing Fish Story in Seattle with the support of the union and so on. And it seemed like coming full circle to do something with the Liverpool Dockers. But what happened was I finally made it to Liverpool in July, and it was just at the time when the film that showed recently on Channel 4 was released. And this is a film co-written by these former dock workers. And so they basically came up with a script through a writer's workshop working with Jimmy McGovern and Irvine Welsh. And so they've been transformed really from dock workers into people who are doing something like what artists do or what writers do or perhaps what architects do, which is they're making things with cultural import. And this diptych is for me the structuring pair of images for the work now. The picture on the left is called Ship Spotter, and it's taken in New Brighton, and it's a man. I have no reason to believe he's a dock worker, but he's clearly interested in ships. And he's looking at a Canadian container vessel coming into the port. I was very happy that it was orange. And then on the right, dockers at their meeting place, which is in a Catholic church in Liverpool. It's a temporary quarters for them. They just bought a nightclub in the center of the city, which they're converting into their new center for the Initiative Factory, which is their effort to keep going and retain their solidarity and be involved in cultural work. And they're listening to a BBC radio program, call-in show with people commenting on the film. So they're involved in a kind of cultural discourse here. And so it's called Dockers Listening, this photograph. They're very intent. People are calling in. Some people are complaining about the use of the F word. Other people are calling in saying we should have been more militant, you know, to me, and so on. And then two dockers, former dockers, Marty Size in the rear and Mickey Tye in the front, looking through the fence at the Seaforth container facility, the place where they used to work. And it's a very, you know, kind of depressing. It was very generous of them to take me there because it's hard for them emotionally to go to this place because they're outlawed there. They can't go in, and you know they have this lingering proprietary sense of their own jobs. And at one point, Mickey said to Marty, "Look, Marty, there's your machine as a front loader. You know, container handling machine was roaring through the stacks of containers." And I thought, "Yeah, well, would that it was his machine, but it isn't." And then this is the headquarters of the Transport and General Workers Union in Liverpool, which failed to support the Liverpool Dockers. So I made this picture called Speak Here. And you can see this wall, you know, between the union office and you know, the various slogans, the image of Bill Morris, the head of the TNG, and so on. Had the Transport and General Workers supported the Liverpool Dockers, the outcome of their fight might have been different. Oops, sorry, did it again. And then, how am I doing on time? I think I should finish up here. The last two pictures from Liverpool, again, the scale is off. I'm sorry, the slide on the left is reversed. So you've got Ireland floating over there somewhere near France or Holland. Is it possible to reverse that slide, or would that be too difficult to do? I'm sorry, I'm being finicky. Just pop it up and twist it around. The scale of these pictures, again, is completely off. The picture on the left is quite large. It's about 3 by 6 feet. And the picture on the right is just 16 by 20 inches. So it's a little picture in it. And actually, the picture on the right is on the left. Okay, you get the idea. It's approximate. I'm sorry. The picture on the left is taken at Albert Dock, and it's this weather map that Granada Television, I think, still uses. It's a group of mostly boys, but one girl who happens to be in mid-leap. She's jumping from somewhere like Portsmouth, heading out to the very beginning of the channel. And they've swum. They're sort of, you know, it's a hot summer day, and they're just sort of rowdy kids swimming across the dock at some peril because their boat's roaring around. And then they're about to climb up the dock and go into a candy store and sweet shop and pilfer these dripping wet kids pilfering candy and running through the crowd, rather lackadaisically chased by the police. An image for me of all that is, you know, that kind of proletarian energy and rudeness and joy that I think is one of the great legacies of working class culture in Liverpool. And then on the right, a portrait of John Stanson, a guard at the Tate Gallery, Liverpool. And I'll conclude by reading the caption to that. It's called Portrait Number 3. So this is Queen of the Pirates on the left, and on the right, Portrait 3, and here's the extended caption. John Stanson, former merchant seafarer and dock clerk, has worked as a guard at the Tate Gallery, Liverpool, since its opening in 1998. Anticipating the dismantling of the National Dock Scheme by the Tories in 1989, he left the working docks for a more poorly paid job attending to the cultural renovation of the derelict Liverpool waterfront. He says, "Thank God for the yuppies. They're the only reason any of us have jobs." An articulate and knowledgeable historian of the Albert Dock, which he describes as the Cape Canaveral of its day, he gives me a wry look and responds with a question when I ask why the specific history of the dock, with its innovative hydraulic cranes and bonded warehouses, is unrepresented at the Merseyside Maritime Museum next door to the Tate. He says, "Are you familiar with Gramsci's idea of cultural hegemony?" Okay, I'll end there.
Wow. Wow. How refreshing.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say, Steve?
Oh, boy. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Steve and I both go to so many contemporary art shows.
So many.
So many of them are about, you know, new materials and painted the color of sunsets.
It's like a Los Angeles thing, right?
Nice to hear about an artist who's just engaged with the horrible atrocity that is the global society we live in. Wouldn't you say, Steve?
Yeah. And also just who puts so much work into a caption for a photo, you know, obviously aware that the photo itself tells you nothing, you know, so relaxed in his clear understanding of where a photo can go and then where it can't go, you know. I think that's something that's really a pleasure about Alan's work. And, you know, I did study with Alan as well, right?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you did. You were down up at CalArts when Al was teaching there. What was that like, Steve? Did you get a chance to study with him?
Yeah, it was great. I genuinely miss the guy. I think we really lost a great light in contemporary art when Alan left a couple years ago. He was great. You know, he was someone who is very clear in what his investments and interests are, but was also really capable of understanding how one would want to approach things in a different way. So although he has this aura of being very doctrinaire, you know, he's got a very straightforward approach to thinking about labor politics, for example, very unambiguous as to what side Alan Sekulé is on. At the same time, he's very ambiguous in terms of how he wants to proceed within his work, I think. So it was a real pleasure to see both sides of that in action, you know? If that makes sense. Yeah.
Very nice. Well, Al's talk was rather long, but very rigorous. And in my opinion, essential reading for the contemporary artist. So, without any further ado, good night, Chinatown.
Good night.